Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Two of the most common questions I receive from listeners and social media followers are, what is your favorite historical period, and who is your favorite historical figure? My answers are invariably linked to each other. While I am fascinated by the pre-colonial era, it is Canada's fur trade era of the 1700s that truly scratches my history itch. For my favorite historical figure, there are many to choose from, but one reigns above all. This person mapped out a huge part of Western Canada so accurately, his work was still being used into the 20th century. He spent so much time looking at the night sky, the Indigenous peoples called him the man who looks at stars. Throughout his life, he felt towering highs and crushing lows. I'm Craig Baird, this is Canadian History X, and this is the story of my favorite historical figure, David Thompson. David Thompson was born on April 30th, 1770 in Westminster, on the north bank of the River Thames, on the heart of London's West End, to Welsh immigrants David and Anne Thompson. When David was two, his father died, leaving his mother Anne to care for the family. His mother did what she could, but there was little in the way of a social safety net at the time, and without a husband, her financial options were deeply limited. With no other choice, she put David into the Greycoat Hospital in London in 1777. Opened in 1698, Greycoat was a school for orphaned and poor children. It provided an education, and David learned basic mathematics, reading, and other skills that served him well later in life. David did well enough that the treasurer of Greycoat, unnamed in my research, helped him become an apprentice with the Hudson's Bay Company. The treasurer paid £5 for David's admission, and on May 28, 1784, David left England to begin a new life in Canada as an indentured servant, primarily doing the work of a clerk and general laborer in one of the company's forts along the coast of Hudson Bay. On September 2, 1784, David arrived at Churchill River Post, located at the present site of Churchill, Manitoba. Now, during his life at the orphanage, David didn't have much, but it was more than what he found in his new home. He wrote, "A small room was allotted to me without the least article of furniture, but a hard bed for the night. My fellow clerks were in the same position. They were not comfortable, but resigned, and I had to become so." For the first 10 days of David's new life in Canada, there was a lot of hustle and bustle. Supplies from the ship he arrived on were unloaded, and when that was done, the ship was loaded up with furs collected over the previous year from the Indigenous peoples. When the work was done, things settled and he watched the ship's departure. David saw just how remote and isolated he truly was. He wrote, "While the ship remained at anchor, my parent and friends appeared only a few weeks' distance. But when the ship sailed and from the top of the rocks I lost sight of her, the distance became immeasurable, and I bid a long and sad goodbye to my noble, my sacred country, in exile, forever." His first job was to copy the personal papers of Samuel Hearne, the governor of Churchill River Post, who was a legendary explorer in his own right. It was a tedious task, but the work sparked an interest in David to discover more about this continent he now called home. The papers were compiled into the book, A Journey from Prince of Wales Fort in Hudson's Bay to the Northern Ocean, and it chronicled the three journeys taken by Hearne from 1770 to 1772. He became the first known European explorer to walk from Hudson Bay to the Arctic Ocean. When David wasn't copying, he was getting the fort ready for the harsh Hudson Bay winter, and he wrote, "All of our movements, more or less, were for self-preservation. All the wood that could be collected for fuel gave us only one fire in the morning and another in the evening." But his life in Churchill was not the last. In 1785, a year after his arrival, he was transferred to York Factory, 225 kilometers to the south along the Hudson Bay coast. He made the journey on foot and was joined by two Indigenous men. It was his first time living off the land and sleeping under the stars. It took them 2 weeks to make the journey, and along the way they ate ducks and geese and avoided polar bears. David's intelligence, working knowledge of the Cree language, and resourcefulness soon impressed his superiors in the Hudson's Bay Company, and a year after arriving at York Factory, he was off again to a new, unknown destination. In 1786, David was sent to Cumberland House, located 700 kilometers to the southwest of York Factory, near the present-day location of Flin Flon, Manitoba. The journey was not a stroll through the beautiful countryside. Although his superiors were impressed with him, his ranking in the company was still low, so David experienced a back-breaking journey as he took on much of the grunt work that was made worse by buzzing pests. He wrote, "The labor is not more than common, but rendered dreadful by the torment of mosquitoes." On this journey, he first came across French-Canadian voyageurs working for the Northwest Company. He noticed that unlike his own group, they seemed to be happy, singing as they paddled with a large load of furs, and he wrote, "The men were all French Canadians with long red or blue caps, half of which hung down the head. They wore gray blanket coats belted around their waist, their trousers of gray cloth or dress leather, and their shoes of the same." David spent the summer at Cumberland House, and then in September he left with 14 others to establish South Branch House, north of present-day Saskatoon. He returned to Cumberland House in the spring of 1787, that's when David had a life-changing experience. He was visited by the devil in a dream, and David wrote about it in his journal. "I was sitting at a small table with the checkerboard before me, when the devil sat down opposite to me. According to David, they played, and the devil lost each game. He said, he got up, or rather disappeared. My eyes were open, as it was broad daylight. I looked around. All was silence and solitude. Was it a dream, or was it reality? I could not decide." Never one for religion before, David became a devout Christian from then on. Later in 1787, David was sent on his longest journey yet to meet with the Piikani people. The Hudson's Bay Company hoped to establish trading relations with the Piikani, with the Cree serving as intermediaries. On this trip to the Alberta foothills, David met Sacamapi, an 80-year-old elder who told him about the indigenous people of the Canadian West. He told David that smallpox had killed hundreds of his people, including an entire enemy band, who died before the Piikani people could do a nighttime raid. When the Piikani took the possessions of the enemy camp, the smallpox spread to them. Sacamapi told David, "We had no belief that one man could give it to another, any more than a wounded man could give his wound to another. We shall never be again the same people." The experience had a deep impact on David, who would become an ally to the indigenous people. He became an acute and sympathetic observer in a time when Europeans saw them as savage. As he continued his travels west, David saw an awe-inspiring sight for the first time, the Rocky Mountains. He had grown up in England and had lived close to Hudson Bay, so seeing the majestic mountain range made a huge impact, and he wrote, "The Rocky Mountains came in sight like shining white clouds on the horizon. As we proceeded, they rose in height. Their immense masses of snow appeared above the clouds and formed an impassable barrier, even to the eagle." He wintered with the Piikani and was introduced to the war chief Kootenay Apii. Upon his first meeting, David committed a cultural gaffe that could have gone very wrong. When Kootenay was introduced, David extended his right hand, a gesture the Piikani viewed as an invitation to fight. And in a fight, the young David would have stood no chance against the seasoned warrior. Thankfully, Kootenay knew better and laughed off the misunderstanding. Kootenay then promised to protect David in his time in Piikani territory. But when David left Piikani territory, he suffered a horrible injury that changed his entire future. On December 23, 1788, David was at Pine Island Fort, located on an island in the North Saskatchewan River, east of present-day Lloydminster. While working outside, he fell down an embankment and seriously fractured his tibia. It was not detailed how serious the injury was, but it was likely a compound fracture where the bone breaks through the skin. It took hours for his fellow travelers to find him and carry him back to the fort. By then, his leg was severely swollen and not healing properly. That kind of injury could be fatal or crippling. It took 3 months before David could even get out of bed, and 5 months before he was able to walk with the help of crutches. By the 6th month, a fur brigade was heading towards York Factory, and David went with them. Unable to walk beyond a few steps, he was much more cargo than passenger. They were traveling by boat, and the plan was to take David to York Factory for transport back to England. It seemed his Canadian adventure was over. But the pain of the journey was so bad that David was unloaded at Cumberland House, the next stop down the river. He spent the rest of that summer in bed. The long recovery could have driven some people mad, but David called it a blessing in disguise. He wrote, "By the mercy of God, it was the best thing that ever happened to me." He couldn't do much, so he expanded his mind. He learned everything he could about astronomy, mathematics, and surveying, where he was helped by Hudson Bay Company surveyor Philip Tuner. Tuner was very impressed with David and wrote to the Hudson's Bay Company directors in London. "I have inserted some observations which were made and worked by your honor's unfortunate apprentice, David Thompson. I am fully convinced they are genuine, and should he ever recover his strength far enough to be capable of undertaking expeditions, I think your honors may rely on his reports to the situation of any place he may visit." It took David 2 years to recover from that broken leg, and he spent so much time studying the stars through a sextant that he went blind in one eye. In the early spring of 1790, David took 41 astronomical fixes of Cumberland House. Feeling competent enough as a surveyor, he recorded the first description of the outpost's longitude and latitude, and his readings were extremely exact, so much so that in the past 2 centuries, it's not been changed by modern surveyors and equipment. Now recovered, David was sent to York Factory to continue his apprenticeship, which was fast coming to an end. Traditionally, when an apprentice reached the end of their time with the Hudson's Bay Company, they were given a pair of fine clothes as a parting gift. David asked if, instead of fine clothes, he could receive surveying tools. The Hudson's Bay Company gave him both the clothes and the tools, and then offered him a 3-year contract with the company worth £15 per year. And David promptly said yes. Blind in one eye, and with a permanent limp, David was about to embark on a journey to become one of the world's greatest surveyors and explorers, and my favorite figure in history. The first step of his journey began in 1792 with David's first significant survey. The company tasked him with furthering the research of Philip Tuner, who in the year previous started looking at the waterways leading to Lake Athabasca. Lake Athabasca is located at the present-day border of northern Alberta and Saskatchewan, and was first explored by Sir Alexander Mackenzie in the 1780s. David completed his survey and successfully mapped a route to Lake Athabasca. In 1793, David completed 34 observations of the longitude of Cumberland House using lunar distances. He accomplished this by spending 3 hours on each calculation, which created a mean error factor far below what was thought possible at the time. In the autumn of 1794, he was asked to survey the waterways between the Nelson and Churchill Rivers in present-day Manitoba. The area was growing in importance as the Hudson's Bay Company competed with the Northwest Company over fur. The Northwest Company was founded in Montreal in 1779 as a rival to the monopoly held by the Hudson's Bay Company, and whereas the Hudson's Bay Company kept its forts along Hudson Bay and traded with the indigenous peoples who came directly to their forts, the Northwest Company did things differently. The company went into the interior of Canada and traded with the indigenous peoples before they made it to Hudson Bay and diverted trade away from the Hudson's Bay Company. The Northwest Company built forts in the interior of the continent, making it easier for the indigenous peoples to trade with them. This caused the Hudson's Bay Company to alter how it did business, and the company began to establish forts and trading posts within the continent as well. In his surveys of the waterways between the Nelson and Churchill Rivers, David established a fort at Sipawesk Lake, and then surveyed a route to Churchill by way of the Burntwood River. For his work, David was promoted to surveyor in 1794 and given a raise to £60 per year. On July 18, 1794, he left York Factory and stayed in Churchill for the winter. And for the next 2 years, he surveyed the land from Churchill to York Factory with the aid of 2 Chippewan guides, and then returned to York Factory for the winter of 1796. And everything was going well for David. He had a job he loved that gave him the freedom he craved. But in 1797, everything came to a halt. David Thompson lived to survey, and was all he wanted to do. And for him, the fur trade was secondary. And that was not the case for the Hudson's Bay Company. And as talented as David was, they wanted him to focus more on trading furs rather than mapping rivers. In early 1797, the Hudson Bay Company ordered David to stop surveying and focus completely on the fur trade. To entice him, they offered him the role as Master of the Northward, where his primary duties would be to trade fur. And this was a big promotion for someone who was only 27. But David refused it outright, He saw the promotion as nothing more than a desk job. If he could not survey, he would not work for the Hudson's Bay Company. On May 23, 1797, he ceased his employment and walked 130 kilometers through a late spring snowstorm to the nearest Northwest Company fort. When he arrived, he was immediately hired as a surveyor. David wrote in his journal, "This day left the service of the Hudson's Bay Company and entered the company of merchants from Canada. May God Almighty prosper me." Now an employee of the Northwest Company, he was sent to survey part of the Canada-US border along the water routes from Lake Superior to the Lake of the Woods. The Jay Treaty had been signed between England and the United States in 1794, and this would resolve any unresolved concerns over territory left over from the American Revolutionary War. The Northwest Company also needed to know which of its forts were on the American side, and David was told by the company that he was to mark the line of the 49th parallel of latitude wherever he could, especially in the Red River area of present-day Manitoba. The Northwest Company sent messages ahead to forts, and David was to receive any men he needed and any supplies he requested. He was also told to catalog indigenous villages and record what he could of the inhabitants who lived there in the hopes they could become trading partners. And David wrote this was a big change from how he dealt with the Hudson's Bay Company. He said, "How very different the liberal and public spirit of the Northwest Company of Merchants of Canada from the mean, selfish policy the Hudson's Bay Company styled honorable, and whom at little expense might have had the northern part of this continent surveyed to the Pacific Ocean." On August 9, 1797, David left Grand Portage in what is now Minnesota with a fur trade brigade and journeyed west towards present-day Manitoba. While in the area, he traveled to various trading posts and took fixes of their positions. He also sent a cursory map east to the Northwest Company and then left with a group of 9 men to travel to the confluence of the Surrey and Assiniboine River. Unfortunately, it was November and the cold weather slammed the party as they journeyed along the 49th parallel. Temperatures fell to minus 35 degrees Celsius. But after 33 days, they reached Amandan Village in what is now North Dakota. David cataloged the village, the people, and recorded a vocabulary of 375 words. For the next 3 weeks, David fixed positions of Northwest Company forts in the area and discovered several of the forts were on the southern side of the 49th parallel. They would have to be moved out of the United States. Through the winter, he surveyed along the 49th parallel while slowly making his way back to Grand Portage. Along the way, he completed the first chart of the shoreline of Lake Superior. During 1797-98, David covered 6,440 kilometers and found that the Northwest Company would have to abandon several posts and relocate its western headquarters from Grand Portage. This was accomplished in 1803 when Fort Kaministiquia was established on the northern shore of Lake Superior. Today, we know that place under a different name, Thunder Bay. The following year, David traveled up the Upper Churchill River to the Beaver River and along the Red Deer River to establish the trading post of Lac La Biche, which is still located in present-day east-central Alberta. After the fort was established, he took the North Saskatchewan River to the Athabasca River and then the Pembina River. And while he was surveying the area, he married Charlotte Small on June 10, 1799. If you're a longtime listener of Canadian History X, that name might sound familiar. I encourage you to listen to her episode because this is where the two stories intersect. Their union was considered a country marriage, which were very common at the time and involved a European man and an indigenous woman. Unfortunately, it often ended with Europeans abandoning their wives and family when their contracts were done. And that would not be the case for David and Charlotte, who remained married for 58 years, the longest known pre-Confederation marriage in Canadian history. Following their marriage, David and Charlotte spent the next year at Rocky Mountain House in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and upon his second sight of the range, he wrote, "Here we have a grand view of the Rocky Mountains, forming a concave segment of a circle. All its snowy cliffs to the southward were bright with the beams of the sun, while the most northern were darkened by a tempest which spent its force only on the summits." Duncan McGilvray was a fellow explorer and trader, and he arrived at Rocky Mountain House in 1800. David left for a journey south with him on November 17, 1800. In just 6 days, they covered 270 kilometers into Pikinee territory, where they met with the nation to agree to trading terms. They then turned west and traveled towards present-day Banff. There, they scaled a mountain to get a better lay of the land, and David wrote, "Our view from the heights and eastward was vast and unbounded. The eye had not the strength to discriminate its termination to the westward hills, and rocks rose to our view covered with snow, here rising, there subsiding, but their tops nearly of an equal height everywhere." The men then returned to Rocky Mountain House, where they spent the winter. In 1802, Thompson returned to Montreal to meet with the directors of the Northwest Company, where he met John Jeremiah Bigsby. The British geologist provides us with one of the few descriptions of David Thompson. It states, "He was plainly dressed, quiet, and observant. His figure was short and compact, and his black hair was worn long all around and cut square, as if by one stroke of the shears, just above the eyebrows. His complexion was that of a gardener's ruddy brown, while the expression of his deeply furrowed features was friendly and intelligent, but his cut-short nose gave him an odd look." Bigsby and David became close friends and traveled together for a time. Bigsby described David as, "No living person possesses a tithe of his information respecting the Hudson Bay countries. Never mind his bunion-like face and cropped hair, he has a very powerful mind and a singular faculty of picture-making." David's work was incomparable. Very few had his abilities, and to reward him, the Northwest Company made him a full partner on July 10, 1804. For his efforts, he received 2 shares of the 92 available in the company worth £4,000. And as happy as David was to receive the recognition and increased pay, he was growing dissatisfied with his role. Since 1802, he had spent more time in Montreal than in the wilderness. His duties as a partner in the company would mean more meetings and less surveying. He was giving serious thought to retiring, but in 1806, a decision was made by the company that took David on his greatest journey yet. In 1806, the Northwest Company was growing anxious of the overland expedition to the Pacific coast by Lewis and Clark. That expedition began on May 14, 1804 and lasted 862 days until September 23, 1806. The journey took the two men and their party from the east coast of the United States through the newly acquired land from the Louisiana Purchase to the Pacific coast. The Northwest Company wanted to establish forts on the other side of the Rocky Mountains in present-day British Columbia to prevent American expansion, and it was up to David Thompson to achieve that gateway to a new territory. On May 10, 1807, David left on his journey with his wife Charlotte, their 3 children, and 7 other men. They traveled up the North Saskatchewan River and wintered at Rocky Mountain House before venturing further west. On June 25, 1807, the party crossed into the Rocky Mountains along the border of present-day Alberta and British Columbia. He wrote in his journal, "At length, the Rocky Mountains came in sight like shining white clouds on the horizon, but we doubted what our guide said. But as we proceeded, they rose in height, their immense masses of snow appearing above the clouds and formed an impassable barrier, even to the eagle. May God in his mercy give me to see where the waters of this river flow to the Western Ocean." David and the party descended the Blaeberry River and reached a river he named the Kutana, known today as the Columbia River. Born south of present-day Invermere, British Columbia, the river travels north and then turns south, running through Revelstoke, Castlegar, and Trail until it reaches the U.S. border and winds its way to the Pacific coast. David made his way upriver with his party in the hopes of finding indigenous people with whom he could trade with for food, as they were beginning to starve. He wrote, "The men were now so weak that, however willing, they had not the strength to work, and some of them told me that 2 or 3 days more of famine would bring them to the ground. They were able to keep alive with some fishing, trading for pemmican with the Kootenai people, and the skills of Charlotte Small for snaring small game and harvesting food from berries and other plants. By the end of August, the food supplies were improving as wildlife became more plentiful. On October 2nd, with the help of an indigenous man named Ugly Head, because of his unruly hair, David reached Columbia Lake, the headwaters of the Columbia River. This is where he established Kootenai House, and where the group spent the winter. In the spring of 1808, he surveyed the nearby Kootenai River and then began the journey back to Rocky Mountain House. Along the journey, he had a brief scare when his daughter Emma disappeared, and he wrote that he believed she had drowned, stating, "We searched all the log jams in the river, but to no purpose. At length, Mr. McDonald found her track going upwards, searched all about, and at length, thank God, at 8:30 p.m., found her about 1 mile off against a bank of snow." On June 25th, the group reached Rocky Mountain House after a year away. Then 2 years later, in 1810, David started to journey eastward to Montreal, where he was given orders to return to the Rocky Mountains and establish a route all the way to the mouth of the Columbia River. The Northwest Company had heard that John Jacob Astor was sending a ship around South America to establish a fur trading post for the Pacific Fur Company at the estuary of the Columbia River, and the Northwest Company wanted to beat him to it. With his new orders, David turned back to the Rocky Mountains. He was now approaching 50, and the time outdoors was getting hard on his body. While in Rocky Mountain House, he wrote a letter to his friend, Finan MacDonald, stating, "If all goes well and it pleases good providence to take care of me, I hope to see you in the civilized world in the autumn of 1812. I'm getting tired of such constant hard journeys. For the last 12 months, I've spent barely 2 months under the shelter of a hut. All the rest have been in my tent, and there is little likelihood the next 12 months will be much different." In his journey to the Rocky Mountains, he would also have to find a new route. David could not take the Blaeberry Pass because an indigenous nation occupied the area, so he turned to his wife Charlotte for help. David tried to find a river route through the mountains and only found failure, so Charlotte persuaded him to try the Athabasca River. On her advice, David made a portage from Rocky Mountain House to near present-day Hinton, where he ascended the Athabasca into the mountains and wintered near what is now Jasper. In the spring, Charlotte told her husband to go up the Whirlpool River. He once again listened and discovered the Athabasca Pass, which allowed him to go into present-day British Columbia through the mountains. As he camped at the top of the pass, he wrote, "My men were not at ease, yet when the night came, they admired the brilliancy of the stars, as one of them said he thought he could almost touch them with his hand. Many reflections came to mind. A new world was in a manner before me." This pass became a popular route for fur traders until it was replaced with the Yellowhead Pass in the latter part of the 19th century. David and his party then began their journey down the Columbia River towards the Pacific coast. In April 1811, he reached Spokane House near present-day Spokane, Washington. There, he built a new canoe for the last leg of the journey. On July 3, 1811, he left and proceeded down the river the rest of the way, and 6 days later, near the entrance of Snake River into the Columbia, David wrote, "I erected a small pole with a half sheet of paper tied about it with these words, 'Know hereby this country is claimed by Great Britain and the Northwest Company from Canada. Do hereby intend to erect a factory on this place for the commerce of the country.'" At 1 p.m. on July 15, 1811, David reached the partially constructed Fort Astoria. David had arrived 2 months too late, and the Northwest Company was beaten in setting up the post. Gabriel Franchet, one of the head officials of the new Fort Astoria, wrote of the arrival of David Thompson, "Toward midday, we saw a large canoe with a flag displayed at our stern, rounding the point, which we called Tongue Point. We knew not who it would be, for we did not expect our own party, nor to cross the continent by the route which Captains Lewis and Clark had followed." David and his party's arrival was a surprise to the men in the fort, but they were welcomed and treated as friends, despite working for rival companies. Gabriel wrote, "The flag she bore was the British, and her crew was composed of 8 Canadian boatmen and voyageurs. A well-dressed man, who appeared to be the commander, was the first to leap ashore and, addressing us without ceremony, said that his name was David Thompson and that he was one of the partners of the Northwest Company." They stayed for just over a week to prepare for their journey back east, and then Gabriel wrote, "Mr. Thompson kept a regular journal and traveled. I thought more like a geographer than a fur trader. He was provided with a sextant, chronometer, and barometer, and during a week's sojourn, which he made at our place, had an opportunity to make several astronomical observations." On July 22, 1811, David set off from the Columbia River, joined by a Pacific Fur Company boat, before they parted ways as his party traveled north. For David, this was the end of an era that began 27 years earlier during his first surveys of the Canadian West. He'd accomplished his dream of mapping the West, and he was ready for retirement. He said, "Thus, I have fully completed the survey of this part of North America from sea to sea. By almost unnumberable astronomical observations, have determined the positions of the mountains, lakes, and rivers, and other remarkable places of the northern part of this continent, the maps of all which have been drawn and laid down in geographical position, being now the work of 27 years." After wintering at Salish House until 1812, David crossed back over the Rockies for the last time and headed towards Montreal, where he officially retired 17 months after he left the Columbia River estuary. He was given a generous pension worth £100 plus a full share of company profits for 3 years. And settled down, David began to work on his magnum opus, a giant map. It was a summary of a lifetime of work. The map covers the area from Lake Superior to the Pacific. He completed one large map and another made up of several smaller maps pieced together. The large map was sent to Fort William, where it hung in the Great Hall for half a century. The other map, 3 meters long by 2 meters high, is now in a special cabinet at the Archives of Ontario in Toronto. The maps were so accurate, they were still being used by the Canadian government a century later. In 1815, David and the family moved to Williamstown, Upper Canada, and lived on a farm he purchased from Reverend John Bethune. If that name sounds familiar, that's because his descendant is Dr. Norman Bethune. I covered his story in an episode in 2023, but you might remember he's also related to our third Prime Minister, Sir John Abbott, who's also the great-grandfather of actor Christopher Plummer. This means that David Thompson and his family bought a farm from Plummer's great-great-great-great-grandfather. I don't know how many degrees of Kevin Bacon, but everything in Canadian history is connected. David had retired, but his love of surveying was still strong, even if his body was getting too old for it. Following the War of 1812, a border was established, and from 1815 to 1820, he surveyed it along the St. Lawrence River towards Sault Ste. Marie, which was a bit easier because it was closer to civilization. With this work completed, he returned to his life as a landowner and became the Justice of the Peace for his region in 1820. But financially, the family was struggling. His shares in the Northwest Company became worthless when it was absorbed into the Hudson's Bay Company in 1821. Most of his remaining wealth was invested in land, giving him little in the way of an income. He'd invested in a potash production company and 2 general stores, all of which failed. By 1831, most of David's money was gone, and by 1833, he was so deep in debt that he had to give up much of his land over to creditors. Now in his 60s, David returned to work and conducted hydrographic surveys for the British North America Land Company. In 1837, he conducted a survey of the waterways between Lake Huron and the Ottawa River. The work was hard on him physically, and over the next decade, he slowed down and his income decreased. In 1845, he and his family moved to a rented house in Montreal, where money remained tight and the family moved several more times. In August 1840, at the age of 70, he applied to be a clerk with the Hudson's Bay Company, the same position he had over 50 years earlier, and he was turned down. One of the final jobs he ever completed was surveying the vast estate of fellow explorer Sir Alexander Mackenzie. But unlike him, things for David were financially dire, and eventually, he was forced to sell his precious surveying tools to feed the family and pay the rent. In his final years, David and Charlotte were forced to move in with their daughter and son-in-law to save money, and he spent his days working on his journals, consisting of 77 field books. He hoped his work would be published, but he found no takers. In 1851, David went completely blind. He spent the last 6 years of his life as a man lost in the memories of the wilderness he helped to explore. On February 10, 1857, David Thompson died. 3 months later, Charlotte joined him. And that may seem like a tragic end to the story, except decades later, a man came along to give David the glory he deserved. In 1889, geologist J.B. Tyrrell, the man who found dinosaur fossils in the Alberta Badlands, purchased David Thompson's notes from one of David's sons. He became enthralled by the narrative and fascinated by the man who mapped a large portion of Western Canada, and he looked for a publisher. Tyrrell said of David, "There were few white men in the West in those early days who bore so consistently as he did the white flower of a blameless life." David Thompson's narrative was published in 1916 and has remained in print ever since. Tyrrell also bought a headstone for David's unmarked grave in the Mount Royal Cemetery in Montreal. And the book brought a new interest in David Thompson, and he was named a National Historic Person in 1926. And since then, the honors have just flooded in. Historical plaques celebrate Thompson in several areas in Alberta and British Columbia. At Lac La Biche, a statue marks his arrival on October 4, 1798. Other statues and monuments pay tribute to him in North Dakota, Montana, and British Columbia. In 1957, Canada Post issued a stamp. The David Thompson Highway, commonly referred to as Highway 11 in central Alberta, runs from Saskatchewan River Crossing near Mount Sarbach in Banff National Park and travels east to Nevis Passing Rocky Mountain House. There are three secondary schools named for him, two in BC in Invermere and Vancouver and one in Leslieville, Alberta. In 1958, Charles Sandel, the great-grandson of David Thompson, opened the David Thompson Stampede on Rocky Mountain House, the place that David and Charlotte were so long associated with during their lives. In 2007, a commemorative plaque was placed on the wall of Greycoat Hospital in London to honor the time that David attended there. And today, David is considered by some historians to be the greatest land geographer that the world has ever produced. But why do I love him? I have a strong fascination with Canada's fur trade era. It was a time before there were fences and roads, or cities of concrete and glass peppering the land. You could choose a direction and just walk. Now, I do understand that as a romanticized view, but for me, David Thompson represents freedom. He was able to wander, choosing a direction without being impeded. When I first watched Canada People's History in 2000, one of the episodes focused on David Thompson and his life. It outlined the life, the man who looked at stars, and I was fascinated by it from that moment on. David Thompson was a man who bucked the trends of the day. He had honor and integrity. He was a man who was born into poverty, raised in an orphanage, and shipped to a place far from his home. He dealt with hardship and loneliness, and suffered a terrible injury. His life could have taken many paths, but through his own perseverance and drive, he succeeded in becoming immortal. His legacy makes him a true Canadian legend. For me, David Thompson represents the proof that you can succeed at something you love if you put the work and effort in to make it happen. And he certainly did. I hope you enjoyed that episode and our look at David Thompson. Information comes from Canadian Encyclopedia, David Thompson Country, Wikipedia, Biography, Canadian Museum of History, British Columbia from earliest times to the present, Fort Vermilion before Alberta, the Hudson's Bay Road, Days Before Yesterday, the Conquest of the Great Northwest. This show is researched, produced, and written by me, Craig Baird, with the help of Dila Velasquez. Audio production and design by Rosalind Kufor. If this is your first time listening and you like what you heard, please take a moment and give us a 5-star review to help other people find these amazing stories. And there are so many for you to sink your teeth into. If you enjoy this podcast, then please check out my other podcasts, From John to Justin, Canada, A Yearly Journey, Pucks and Cups, and Canada's Great War. We love hearing from you, so if you have a show topic you want me to cover, email me at craig@canadaehx.com. Or stop by my website and social media. I'll include all of those in my show notes. Until next time, I'm Craig Baird, and this is Canadian History X.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.